Chapter 36. Don't you think 'twould have been better for us to wait till you were quite settled in your Midland farm? She once asked timidly. A Midland farm was the idea just then.
To tell the truth, my Tess, I don't like you to be left anywhere away from my protection and sympathy. The reason was a good one, so far as it went. His influence over her had been so marked that as he had caught his manner and habits, his speech and phrases, his likings and his aversions. And to leave her in farmland would be to let her slip back again out of accord with him. He wished to have her under his charge for another reason. His parents had naturally desired to see her once at least before he carried her off to a distant settlement, English or colonial. And as no opinion of theirs was to be allowed to change his intention, he judged that a couple of months' life with him in lodgings, whilst seeking for an advantageous opening, would be of some social assistance to her at what she might feel to be a trying ordeal, her presentation to his mother at the vicarage. Next, he wished to see a little of the working of a flour mill, having an idea that he might combine the use of one with corn growing. The proprietor of a large old water mill at Wellbridge, once the mill of an abbey, had offered him the inspection of his time-honored mode of procedure, and a hand in the operations for a few days, whenever he should choose to come. Claire paid a visit to the place, some few miles distant, one day at this time, to inquire particulars, and returned to Talbothays in the evening. She found him determined to spend a short time at the Wellbridge flour mills. And what had determined him? Less the opportunity of an insight into grinding and bolting than the casual fact that lodgings were to be obtained in that very farmhouse which, before its mutilation, had been the mansion of a branch of the D'Urberville family. This was always how Claire settled practical questions, by a sentiment which had nothing to do with them. They decided to go immediately after the wedding, and remain for a fortnight, instead of journeying to towns and inns. Then we will start off to examine some farms on the other side of London, that I have heard of, he said, and by March or April we will pay a visit to my father and mother. Questions of procedure such as these arose and passed, and the day, the incredible day, on which she was to become his, loomed large in the near future. The 31st of December, New Year's Eve, was the date. His wife, she said to herself. Could it ever be? Their two selves together, nothing to divide them, every incident shared by them, why not? And yet why? One Sunday morning as Hewitt returned from church, and spoke privately to Tess. You was not called home this morning. What? It should ha' been the first time of asking today, she answered, looking quietly at Tess. Who meant to be married New Year's Eve, dearie? The other returned a quick affirmative. And there must be three times of asking. And now there be only two Sundays left between. Tess felt her cheek paling. Is was right. Of course there must be three. Perhaps he had forgotten. If so, there must be a week's postponement, and that was unlucky. How could she remind her lover? She who had been so backward was suddenly fired with impatience and alarm lest she should lose her dear prize. A natural incident relieved her anxiety. Is mentioned the omission of the banns to Mrs. Crick, and Mrs. Crick assumed a matron's privilege of speaking to Angel on the point. Have ye forgot 'em, Mr. Clare? The banns, I mean. No, I have not forgot 'em, says Clare. As soon as he caught Tess alone he assured her. Don't let them tease you about the banns. A license will be quieter for us, and I have decided on a license without consulting you. So if you go to church on Sunday morning you will not hear your own name, if you wish to. I didn't wish to hear it, dearest, she said proudly. But to know that things were in train was an immense relief to Tess notwithstanding, who had well nigh feared that somebody would stand up and forbid the banns on the ground of her history. How events were favoring her. I don't quite feel easy, she said to herself. LL this good fortune may be scorched out of me afterwards by a lot of ill. That's how heaven mostly does. I wish I could have had common manners. But everything went smoothly. She wondered whether he would like her to be married in her present best white frock, or if she ought to buy a new one. The question was set adrift by his forethought, disclosed by the arrival of some large packages addressed to her. Inside them she found a whole stock of clothing, from bonnet to shoes, including a perfect morning costume, such as would well suit the simple wedding they planned. He entered the house shortly after the arrival of the packages, and heard her upstairs undoing them. A minute later she came down with a flush on her face and tears in her eyes. "How thoughtful you've been," she murmured, her cheek upon his shoulder. Then to the gloves and handkerchief. "My own love, how good, how kind." "No, no, Tess. Just an order to a tradeswoman, in London, nothing more." And to divert her from thinking too highly of him, he told her to go upstairs, and take her time, and see if it all fitted. And, if not, to get the village sempstress to make a few alterations. She did return upstairs, and put on the gown. Alone, she stood for a moment before the glass looking at the effect of her silk attire, and then there came into her head her mother's ballad of the mystic robe that never would become that wife that had once done amiss, which Mrs. Durbeyfield had used to sing to her as a child, so blithely and so archly, her foot on the cradle, which she rocked to the tune. Suppose this robe should betray her by changing color, as her robe had betrayed Queen Guinevere. Since as he had been at the dairy, as he had not once thought of the lines till now. XXXIII, Angel felt that he would like to spend a day with her before the wedding, somewhere away from the dairy, as a last jaunt in her company, while there were yet mere lover and mistress. A romantic day, in circumstances that would never be repeated. With that other and greater day beaming close ahead of them. During the preceding week, therefore, he suggested making a few purchases in the nearest town, and they started together. Claire's life at the dairy had been that of a recluse in respect to the world of his own class. For months he had never gone near a town, and, requiring no vehicle, had never kept one, hiring the dairyman's cob or gig, if he rode or drove. They went in the gig that day. And then for the first time in their lives they shopped as partners in one concern. It was Christmas Eve, with its loads of holly and mistletoe, and the town was very full of strangers who had come in from all parts of the country on account of the day. Tess paid the penalty of walking about with happiness superadded to beauty on her countenance by being much stared at as she moved amid them on his arm. In the evening they returned to the inn at which they had put up, and Tess waited in the entry, while Angel went to see the horse and gig brought to the door. The general sitting room was full of guests, who were continually going in and out. As the door opened, and shut each time for the passage of these, the light within the parlor fell full upon Tess's face. Two men came out and passed by her among the rest. One of them had stared her up and down in surprise, and she fancied he was a Trantridge man, though that village lay so many miles off that Trantridge folk were rarities here. "A comely maid that," said the other. "True, comely enough. But unless I make a great mistake, a negative the remainder of the definition forthwith." Claire had just returned from the stable yard, and, confronting the man on the threshold, heard the words, and saw the shrinking of Tess. The insult to her stung him to the quick, and before he had considered anything at all he struck the man on the chin with the full force of his fist, sending him staggering backwards into the passage. The man recovered himself, and seemed inclined to come on, and Claire, stepping outside the door, put himself in a posture of defense. But his opponent began to think better of the matter. He looked anew at Tess as he passed her, and said to Claire, "I beg pardon, sir, 'twas a complete mistake. I thought she was another woman, 40 miles from here." Claire, feeling then that he had been too hasty, and that he was, moreover, to blame for leaving her standing in an inn passage, did what he usually did in such cases, gave the man 5 shillings to plaster the blow, and thus they parted, bidding each other a pacific good night. As soon as Claire had taken the reins from the hostler, and the young couple had driven off, the two men went in the other direction. And was it a mistake? Said the second one. Not a bit of it. But I didn't want to hurt the gentleman's feelings, not I. In the meantime, the lovers were driving onward. Could we put off our wedding till a little later? Tess asked in a dry, dull voice. Mean if we wished? No, my love. Calm yourself. Do you mean that the fellow may have time to summon me for assault? He asked good-humoredly. No, I only meant if it should have to be put off. What she meant was not very clear, and he directed her to dismiss such fancies from her mind, which she obediently did as well as she could. But she was grave, very grave, all the way home, till she thought, we shall go away, a very long distance, hundreds of miles from these parts, and such as this can never happen again, and no ghost of the past reached there. They parted tenderly that night on the landing, and Claire ascended to his attic. Tess sat up getting on with some little requisites, lest the few remaining days should not afford sufficient times. While she sat she heard a noise in Angel's room overhead, a sound of thumping and struggling. Everybody else in the house was asleep, and in her anxiety lest Claire should be ill she ran up and knocked at his door, and asked him what was the matter. Oh, nothing, dear, he said from within. I'm so sorry I disturbed you. But the reason is rather an amusing one. I fell asleep, and dreamt that I was fighting that fellow again who insulted you, and the noise you heard was my pummeling away with my fists at my portmanteau, which I pulled out today for packing. I am occasionally liable to these freaks in my sleep. Go to bed and think of it no more. This was the last dratm required to turn the scale of her indecision. Declare the past to him by word of mouth she could not, but there was another way. She sat down, and wrote on the four pages of a note sheet a succinct narrative of those events of 3 or 4 years ago, put it into an envelope, and directed it to Claire. Then, lest the flesh should again be weak, she crept upstairs without any shoes, and slipped the note under his door. Her night was a broken one, as it well might be, and she listened for the first faint noise overhead. It came, as usual. He descended, as usual. She descended. He met her at the bottom of the stairs and kissed her. Surely it was as warmly as ever. He looked a little disturbed and worn, she thought. But he said not a word to her about her revelation, even when they were alone. Could he have had it? Unless he began the subject, she felt that she could say nothing. So the day passed, and it was evident that whatever he thought he meant to keep to himself. Yet he was frank and affectionate as before. Could it be that her doubts were childish? That he forgave her, that he loved her for what she was, just as she was, and smiled at her disquiet, as at a foolish nightmare? Had he really received her note? She glanced into his room, and could see nothing of it. It might be that he forgave her. But even if he had not received it, she had a sudden enthusiastic trust that he surely would forgive her. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.